afternoon. This is Nevin Campanella welcoming you to the BBS production of Woodland Star, your net radio source for entertainment and coincidental enlightenment. Hello, folks. That's my new opening line. Today is the first day for Woodland Star, and I guess you would say it's a replacement for Woodland Star's radio. Now, if you'd like to call into our show, the toll-free USA number is 877-270-8714, or call direct to 530-413-4515. And for our Canadian friends, the toll-free number is 888-228-4494. And if all else fails, call 530-876-9026. That's a lot of numbers. I'm not sure that I could remember hearing them over a radio. But if you really do want to call in, go to the BBS website and go to Station 2, and all the call-in numbers and everything else you need is right there. Now, our usual scheduled time is 3:30 p.m. Pacific time on Sundays. And this Saturday show, originally under the name of Woodland Star's Radio, is the last in a series of seminars designed to unlock the secrets of how we create our own reality. Because Woodland Star's radio is being canceled and replaced by Woodland Star, the seminar information will be presented on Woodland Star's Sunday show, but probably not in seminar format. And if you care to look, the entire seminar is available at the Woodland Star website, which is woodlandstar.net. And if you want to write to me, my email address is woodlandstar@hotmail.com. Well, that's a lot of information to cover all in the first 4 minutes of the show. I have a number of things that I really would like to talk about, and I will get to the seminar section in a few minutes. But I think one of the things that I want to speak to now is what will happen on our Sunday show. Woodland Star is not going to have a whole lot of guests. And right after saying that, I also need to say to you, the first three Sundays, starting with tomorrow, we will have a guest each Sunday. And partly because they were originally scheduled with Woodland Star's radio, but also because they do present some damn good information on how we not only can create our own reality, but control our reality. Tomorrow's show is going to be Linda Linderman, who's going to give us a presentation on how to protect your identity. In other words, warding off identity theft, which apparently is that epidemic proportions, and I keep seeing it on television where they keep talking about identity theft and how to protect yourself and so on and so forth. And I'm not personally aware of anyone who has had that problem, but I don't live in an area such as a big city where I might encounter it. However, apparently there is a lot of it going on, especially across the net, with credit cards and so on and so forth. So tune in tomorrow at 3:30 Pacific time, and Linda will give us some coaching on what we can do to prevent identity theft. Well, let's get down to creating your own reality. You know, I've been talking about it now for, this is the third week, and I kept saying, you get what you expect. And that's pretty much what it comes down to. You get what you expect. Well, I certainly was not expecting that I know of the change in the show from Woodland Stars Radio to Woodland Star, but it did occur. Now I have to ask myself, at what level was I creating that situation to produce the change? I keep in mind that we're not alone on this stage of creation. We have a lot of help from a lot of actors and actresses, but you are always a part of it, and you are never apart from it. In other words, you have absolute responsibility. Well, what could we do? What could we actually do to train ourselves to enhance our creative skill in creating our own reality? It's an interesting question. Now, one of the things that I should say is that we do share the stage with others who are also actively creating their own reality. And although the experiences may be painful or they may be entertaining, you're still doing the creating. It's our constant quest for entertainment that's the basis for our desire to create our own reality. So I guess I was looking for a lot of entertainment over the past few weeks. And well, I certainly got it. Well, there is a struggle. There is a definite struggle towards entertainment. Why? Why do we struggle so hard? As a matter of fact, just before Don called, I was watching a movie that I must have seen six times, Stephen King's Langolier. I was just kind of sitting around waiting for the phone call, and I've been watching this movie since 3 o'clock, my time. I've seen it. You would think that I would be really bored with it, but truthfully, there wasn't anything else on, so that was the bottom, that was the least boring thing to do while I was waiting for a phone call. Without the struggle in our quest for entertainment, boredom would prevail. It's that simple. Why do we do what we do? Why do we get so involved? Why do we get so over-involved? And then we complain. Yeah, we actually complain when we start experiencing the result of our over-involvement. We do it because we are constantly trying to get away from boredom. And boredom is there. That's why we constantly create. Now, it's often been stated that what is important is the journey and not the final result. Well, the journey is the struggle towards creation and away from boredom. And in fact, it is part of the duality we experience in daily life. In a sense, the struggle sets up duality experiences. And we shift back and forth, kind of like a ping pong ball across the table. We get it all day long. We get it in our dreams. It's constant. But we do it to keep from getting bored. Now, the reason for three-dimensional existence can be stated as a learning experience. You can do that. But it can just as easily be described as entertainment. If you assume something other than entertainment, you begin a creation process that risks a self-image as a victim. Because the learning, by even using the words, I'm going to learn something, it means that there's something that you are lacking. And if you lack that thing, then you become a victim of circumstance. Well, you're not a victim of circumstance. You're no more a victim of circumstance than I am. Whatever you experience, you create it, and you create it for one simple reason, to keep from getting bored. Now, just because I'm saying that experience is entertainment, it doesn't mean that it's not a lesson. We learn no matter what the reason for existence. The problem is one of semantics. If we use only the word lesson, it implies control from something outside of the self. That's what's implied. However, the concept of entertainment alone does seem to somehow lessen the significance of life itself. And it does. I mean, when I use the word entertainment, I'm well aware that I'm saying entertainment by all the violence, mayhem, plagues, pestilence, and so on and so forth. Well, it does seem to lessen the significance of life itself. And life is significant, but it is entertainment. A less thought-directive word might be experience. Now, without a doubt, some will be offended by the suggestion of the entertainment motive because the intensity of the stage is so clearly extreme. How could wars, famine, disease, and the millions of other earthly experiences be categorized as entertainment? How? Well, think about it. You read about it in a newspaper, you hear about it on television, but you know what you also do? You go watch movies about it. You read books about it. Now, I'm not talking about news. I'm talking about, you know, made-up stuff. There's plenty of pestilence and wars and pain on the planet, so why do we spend our time watching a action-packed movie of, gun shooting and pestilence and dying and death and some of them human mutilation? What is that all about? What draws us to that? We say we don't want it, but we seem to be constantly pulled towards those extreme events. Well, if it's a movie, it's certainly not for a learning experience. It's pure entertainment. If you accept the premise that thought creates, then what difference does it make as to what stage, real, dream, or movie, was in use when the thought left the magician's sleeve? It's all the same thing. The dream, the movie, and what you call reality, it's all the same thing. It's just a different name for the same stage. In all three cases, real, dream, or movie, the thought reverberates throughout the fabric of existence. Now, do they somehow just stop? Or do they drift unceasingly on the never-ending tides of infinity? And are you responsible for those thoughts? A lot of people like to say the thought is energy. So you go to a movie and you're watching mayhem, absolute mayhem, and you're having thoughts about it. What happens to all those thoughts? Do they just disappear? Do they float away? Are they still here? Do they still exist? Of course they do. Nothing ends. That was why we got into such a huge discussion on infinity. They go on forever, never ending on the tides of infinity. So I ask you, are you responsible for your thoughts? Well, now, of course, there's the argument is that thought can't be controlled, so how could you possibly take responsibility for something you cannot control? What I'm here to say is that if you insist on the argument that you can't control thought, it will prevail. Control will always be beyond your grasp. The only thing that is limiting you is what you believe. If you believe in that argument that you can't control your thoughts, of course not. You never will be able to. Relinquish the argument, and experience, or what I call entertainment, will change to fit any desired description. Now, does that mean I do it all the time? Nope. Like everybody else, I get pretty lazy. But if you do relinquish the argument, if you do relinquish it, experience and entertainment will change to your desire. As an example, let's talk about Man Can Never Fly. Prior to 1903, prior to the experience at Kitty Hawk in 1903, the argument was always that it was impossible for man to fly. That's right. It was impossible for man to fly. Orville and Wilbur refused the argument. They just refused it. And the collective experience was then forever changed to fit the fantasy world of the Wright brothers. It was that simple. They relinquished the argument and insisted that man could fly. And of course, now we do. The difference between what you call the real world, the dream world, and the movie world is simply one of perception and belief. In all three cases, your sensory system is activated and you respond accordingly. Doesn't matter whether it's what you call the dream world, real world, or movie world. Your sensory system gets activated and you respond accordingly. The dream world you enter tonight is something that is yet to be. That is, it's part of what is not. Right now it is what is not. Now when you enter that world, you accept your personal history without question. The same way you accept it in what you call the real world. You have a dream. You don't sit down and say, no, wait a minute. Who am I? What's going on here? What happened to my real personal history? No, not at all. Whatever's going on in a dream, you simply accept. Without question. It doesn't matter how bizarre it might seem from this point of view in the real world. You simply accept your personal history as to who you are. You might even look different in the mirror. You don't distinguish one from another by virtue of the experience, during the experience, but rather by shifting your existence between those worlds and then reflecting upon the experience. That's what you do. As an example, in a dream, you don't question the fantastic shifting of events such as, inanimate objects becoming animate. You simply respond to the event. How then do you determine which is real and which is a dream? Well, truthfully, the decision is quite arbitrary and based on the premise that since not all of the experiences of the dream world are possible in the real world, then what is called the dream world must somehow be not real. Now consider for a moment that all the people you encounter in the dream world do not exist in the real world. At times your own personal appearance may be different in each of these worlds. From the point of view of the dream world, is your awake world real, or is that in fact the dream world? Now, attempting to untangle these convoluted concepts requires a different sort of labeling, because pretty soon you can go around and around, which is the real world, the one I'm going to have tonight when I go to sleep, or the one I'm in now thinking about going to sleep tonight. There's a couple of handles you can use. Prime reality, is that which you call awake, prime reality. And it's that which you are currently experiencing via the senses. And non-prime reality of sleep is that which you reflect upon. Now, look real closely at what I just said. If prime reality, what you call awake, is what you are currently experiencing via the senses, how are you going to distinguish that from what we're doing right now as opposed to the dream state? The non-prime reality is that which you reflect upon. In other words, in the dream state, you can reflect upon another reality. Therefore, in the dream state, that then is the prime reality. Both conditions are in constant operation. As an example, what you call being awake does include experiences which are referred to as daydreams, non-prime reality. You're reflecting, okay? Now, in reverse, lucid dreaming, there are experiences during the sleep state in which you reflect upon the state in which you were not asleep, another non-prime reality. Prime reality is simply the reference point of where you maintain the concept of self-awareness. I am here. Non-prime reality is the reference point of I am. Yeah, it gets confusing, but the simplicity of it is there is just simply no way to distinguish the world of being asleep in those dreams and this world that you call awake. Non-prime reality, or, quote, being asleep, is simply the area you reflect upon. Now, using the above concepts of reality, death becomes a condition that is the transition between non-prime realities. Remember, what I said is that the prime reality is the current experience. Death, then, what is it? Well, death becomes that transition between non-prime realities. In effect, when you wake up from your dream world, you may have left behind an audience that is in grief over your passing. Do you know for sure that they're not? Of course not. With that first cup of coffee in the morning, you start reflecting upon the dream, but it's really fleeting, isn't it? The people you left behind in the dream world are soon forgotten, and you move on to your next prime reality experience. Now look how close this is getting to what we know, or at least what the gurus tell us about death. When you transit from the prime reality you commonly call being awake to a state you call death, your next experience will be quite similar to waking from the dream state. That is, you may reflect for a moment on the audience you left behind, but your interest is now held by the excitement of walking through the next doorway of entertainment. That's why people don't come back that much. Communication between prime realities is limited simply because interest changes. I mean, do you really have a concern about trying to communicate with those you left behind in last night's dream? Of course not. The dream is fleeting. Probably most of you have forgotten about what you dreamt, and you're on to something else. Exactly the same thing in death. How do I know this? I know it at an intuitive level. Can I prove it to you? Absolutely not. I simply know this as at an intuitive level. Now, the art of creation requires constant exercises in construction of speech and thought. And the best place to start is with speech. And, of course, it's just easier to begin a project with simple tasks first. What in speech directs the creative process? Well, actually, it's the adjectives that we use. All the adjectives that we use, we think we are defining something that we're seeing, but we're also constructing the next part or phase of that. The adjective that we use is the direction or the director of the creative process. So, you want to gain some experience in control of all this creation? Try going through an entire day, without using any adjectives or other judgmental words or concepts in your communications. Try it. See if you can get through an entire day without an adjective or a judgment. You're going to find it darn difficult. But it's the place to begin. If you can get through the first couple of hours in a social setting without using adjectives, I would be absolutely amazed. And, of course, it might be impractical in a work setting, so set aside some time until the weekend. And you're going to find yourself tripping over your own ego. But that's okay for a start. You got to start somewhere. And getting rid of the adjectives and the judgments is one place to do it. Now, thoughts are going to rise to the surface, which seem to urge you, you know, to kind of push you to vocalize the judgment. I mean, it's easy. As, you know, you're driving down the road, and somebody comes whizzing by at 100 miles an hour and drives too close and pushes you over. Of course you're going to vocalize the judgment and probably give them some hand signals. Well, you have to start in areas that you know you can control. Well, that certainly isn't one of them. I mean, right off the bat, you're never going to be able to do that. But you can do it at a lot lower, a lot less intense moment. As an example, not judging the people that you're passing as you walk down the aisles in Walmart. Reviewing in your mind what they might be like simply because of what they look like. Review the logic of the judgment, but remind yourself that the only significance to the judgment is the entertainment value and nothing else. That's right. That is a tough exercise because most of us are convinced that our judgments have a validity which transcend entertainment and are truths for the entire universe. As a matter of fact, I ran across this yesterday morning. And I'm sure most of you are aware of the trouble going on in Jenna, Louisiana. Well, I was standing in the office of the RV park that I live in, and one older gentleman came in, and he wanted to get a space in the park just for overnight. I was just standing there. I was waiting for the owner to finish up because we were going to do some work together on the cable system in the park. But anyway, while I'm standing there, this older gentleman all of a sudden announces to me that pretty soon you're not going to be able to put anything you want in your pickup truck because it's going to be a federal offense. I had no idea what this man was talking about. I mean, he was going on and on about pickup trucks and what you could and could not do with a pickup truck. So finally, I just finally turned around and said, you know, sir, I really don't know what you're talking about. Well, he goes on to let me know that he thought it was really terrible that there was this law against keeping a noose from hanging out the back of your truck. Well, of course, there is no specific law. But what went on in Jenna, Louisiana, especially with some people riding up and down the road with, you know, hangman nooses hanging out of their truck, is they were trying to incite a riot. That's what's against the law, not hanging a noose out of the back of your truck. Well, what was going on with his judgment? And, I mean, was it entertaining for him? I guess at some level it must have been. How can I describe that man to you? Well, no matter what word I bring up to describe him, of course it's a judgment. And I'm not going to do it. I'm not going to do it. You can arrive at your own conclusions. I don't want any more of those kinds of things in my head. I may disagree with that individual in the way to conduct society, but I am not going to pass judgment. I have enough problems with that without adding more to it. Now, with that kind of thing, we do know that some truths border on obsessiveness and are most visible in discussion of religion or politics. Eventually, with enough concentrated practice, the judgmental thoughts slowly fade away. But they can border on obsessiveness. I mean, you get to a point where you make yourself nuts with it because you start believing everything you're thinking as being an absolute truth. Well, the whole purpose of this particular exercise in getting rid of the adjective is to train your self-awareness into more efficient control of the creative process. It has nothing to do with improving the quality of your character or personality. Interjecting a concept of quality, like good versus bad of any kind, is exactly what will keep you from achieving conscious and immediate control over the creative process. You are what you are. See it for what it is and let it go. Now, if your behavior is interfering with what you want, change your behavior. It really is that simple. But if you think that by getting rid of the adjectives or judgments is somehow going to improve the quality of your character or personality, all you're doing is you're again recreating the very thing that we're trying to get rid of. Well, in all this creation and all this creating that's going on, there is something that I call the theater of existence. Why bring it up? Well, because I've been using the word stage and magician and so on and so forth, and it's starting to sound like what I'm talking about is in fact a stage production, like a play. The theater of existence is the universe. And in terms of creating our own reality, it helps to have some understanding of what we think we know about that theater. You should know it. Now, at this point, you have to keep in focus your a priori assumptions regarding existence. And regardless of which assumption you make, one, we are infinite, or two, we are finite, the theater of existence will be viewed as either random or non-random in composition. Now, this is important. Your conclusion will have an effect on your perception of the level of difficulty for creating your own reality. If you believe that the universe, the theater, is random, then you're going to wind up saying to yourself, well, if it's random, I have absolutely no control over anything. Well, you do have control. So you have to start looking at the universe as non-random. Is there any evidence in one way or the other? Well, at one time, even in physics, there was a kind of a semi-belief that it was in fact, that there was a non-randomness or a randomness about it. Well, the problem is that things kind of got twisted around in terms of physics. There was a notion that the universe was non-deterministic, and it came from a misinterpretation by the public of the phrase chaos theory. Chaos theory is not telling you that the universe is non-deterministic. And if you don't believe me, you go look it up. Start with Wikipedia. This is a good place to start. And Wikipedia presents a very clear definition of chaos theory. The theory itself describes the behavior of certain nonlinear systems that under specific conditions exhibit dynamics that are sensitive to initial conditions. You've heard of this called the butterfly effect. Well, as a result of this sensitivity, the behavior of chaotic systems appears to be random because of an exponential growth of errors in the initial conditions. This happens even though these systems are deterministic in the sense that their future dynamics are well defined. And they are. Well, we somehow kind of got this whole idea of chaos theory to be a suggestion that the universe itself is non-deterministic. I'll tell you, there's an excellent review by G. Stolov, Nah, you don't know who he is, but he's an old science fiction writer. However, there's an even more fascinating, compelling report about how deterministic chaos is. There was a guy named Beno Mandelbrot. So who is he? Well, this goes back to about 30 years back. He was looking at cotton prices. He was conducting an analysis of cotton prices, and he was looking at the fluctuations since 1900. Why was he doing it? Because he was involved in that sort of business. Now, he made a startling discovery. The numbers that produced aberrations from the point of view of a normal distribution produced symmetry from the point of view of scaling. Every price change was random and unpredictable. You with me so far? In other words, there was no way to tell from one price change to the next what was going to happen. However, the sequence of changes was independent on scale. In other words, curves for daily price changes and monthly price changes matched perfectly. When analyzed this way, the degree of variation remained constant over a 60-year period through two world wars and a depression. You could have predicted, in other words, where things would be at in a 60-year period of time. You couldn't predict it from one day to the next, but you could do it damn near by the month and the year, and definitely by the decade. So, how deterministic is it? Well, that would suggest pretty deterministic. I guess when we get right down to the question of, is the universe predictable? A lot of people are going to say, well, the jury is still out on that question. And I can't give a straight answer to that. My own belief is that it is extremely, extremely predictable. Now, Stephen Hawking, you've heard of him. He made an excellent argument for a non-deterministic universe. Actually, he was kind of originally arguing against Einstein. Now, at the quantum level, prediction is precarious. But all that means is we lack the sophistication to understand our own creation. And even Stephen Hawking concludes that God still has a few tricks up his sleeves. See, at one point, Einstein actually came up with a question when he was looking at the quantum side of physics, and he questioned it. He says, does God play dice with the universe? By the way, Einstein was extremely religious. Now, it's doubtful simply because a virtual reality of random events is simply just not as entertaining as an interactive reality of problem solving. What am I saying? I'm saying to you that if all this was a virtual reality of random events, it simply would not be very entertaining because we would not be able to engage the struggle, the journey, to do the problem solving, to find the solutions to the puzzles. The only barrier to creating your own reality is you. And we've been conditioned to believe that we're these fragile victims of chance events. What you need to understand is that in this dimension, there is no such thing as a chance event. The universe is not chaotic. And in fact, it's extremely well organized. You're at the helm. You just don't know it. Now, at this point, we are ready to grab hold of the helm and take direct action on those events. We want to exclude or include our personal reality. For most of us, It's the undesirable events that needs immediate attention. But you got to understand the learning curve for this is really steep. And it requires a lot of patience and being kind to yourself. It really does. What events can we start with? Well, we had a little practice event that, you know, we talked about. Let's start with getting rid of the adjectives so that we're not doing a self-fulfilling prophecy. Is there a common undesirable event for all of us? Sure. It's called pain. Now, each of us have a varying degree of skill in controlling pain. However, it is possible to improve our own technique of controlling pain without the use of medication. This is part of our reality, folks. We have pain. And part of the current reality of the modern world is we take a lot of pain relievers. Like, for instance, why are we all taking so much aspirin? What are all these headaches about? Are we all suffering from some sort of tumor in our skull? No. The majority of headaches is simply due to tension. So why are we taking all these pills? Regardless of your skill level, no matter what happens, when hard times arrive, the shifting of your focus is your best defense. What do I mean by that? I don't mean for you to be Pollyannish, or maybe I do, but such as seeing the beauty in the world, another beautiful day, as the sun rises and sets, or engaging the black humor of whatever doesn't kill you makes you stronger. Regardless of your type of life experience, maintain your sense of humor. The human experience in terms of time is hardly an eye blink when compared to our infinite existence. So how serious do you want to get over something so fleeting? Well, we can't control pain. And again, I had another experience yesterday. A neighbor of mine, he just moved into the park. He's 62 years old. I was outside painting on one of my paintings, and he walks around with a cane. I asked him what had happened to him, why the cane, so on and so forth. Well, he went on to describe this major industrial accident that he had been involved in going back to 1985. And just as he was turning to leave, I think he was going over to the laundry room, he made this comment about wishing that he was dead. And I stopped him right at that point. I said, wait a minute, no, you can't just leave after making a comment like that. Well, it came down to the amount of pain that he was dealing with. I mean, since 1985, this guy has been under an immense amount of pain, taking all kinds of medications, pills, major operations on his spinal cord and his back, and on and on and on. Well, could I offer him some immediate relief by some of the things I'm telling you tonight? Absolutely not. You don't just pick this stuff up and get rid of pain. And I wasn't about to do that to him. I have more respect for people than that. This is something that has a very steep learning curve. But there is something we know about pain. You can't find it under a microscope. It's not three-dimensional. Regardless of the initiating event, all pain is real, and that is something you feel. Now, just because someone doesn't feel what you feel does not make what you feel unreal. But we definitely know some things about pain. All of it originates from the brain. And this is different than a disease, such as a virus or bacteria, which doesn't give a damn how you feel. It'll invade your body and do its thing. Not so with pain. Pain is something that your brain, that you're controlling, often uses to let you know that something has changed, something's different. Something is out of balance. Could be a stab wound or a small sliver under the skin. or an argument you had with your mate. The one thing is for sure, you got to have you and the brain there to have pain. Now, often we think things do not affect us because there's a time delay between the event and the pain. Your emotional self does not react as quickly as your physical self. So the immediate reaction of a substance such as alcohol in triggering a cluster headache is said to be a cause of the problem. However, the slow burn our emotions do are often overlooked as a triggering device because of their slow effect. That is, they're so slow that we don't make the connection in terms of cause and effect. So it's our myopic perception and functional fixedness that keeps us from achieving our goal. Now, this doesn't mean that pain is not stimulated by outside events. It most certainly can be. However, without the brain, between the event and the injury, there is no pain. What this means is that pain is something that can be controlled by you via the brain. And of course, the evidence for this opinion comes from the amount of literature in which people are reported to have controlled some rather amazing painful events, such as having a tooth drilled without anesthesia. I mean, even to me right now, I cringe at the thought of it, but people do it. Can pain be controlled without meditation? Well, the answer to that question depends on what you believe. If you believe that you are a victim, then the answer is no. If you believe that you create your own reality, then the answer is yes. What do you believe? If you can manage the following two beliefs, you're halfway to control of pain. One, that pain, like everything else, begins and ends with our personal belief regarding what we control. And two, that you're not a victim of pain. Because regardless of how it came about, you have absolute control over your own body. Well, can I control all the pain that occurs to me? No. I don't do it now. I keep practicing. I suffer from cluster headaches, and let me tell you, it hurts like hell. But I keep trying. Eventually, I do believe that I will get to a point where I'll be able to exert control over a certain amount of pain, but, you know, like the man Jesus said, they don't have enough faith. It's your belief, it's your absolute belief that is going to lead to what you're going to be able to control. Now, there's a sort of a party line in our society, and it's very clear. It insists that we are all potential victims of disease and illness. And the reasons for this particular prison of ambiguity is simply control and money. You are not a victim of anything unless you choose to be. If you believe the party line, then you will suffer the consequence of the belief. Change belief and you change the outcome. If you like pain and disease, then continue acting like a victim. And if that's no longer entertaining, then stop acting like a victim. You need to start making a life adjustment. Now we're getting more to the macro level in terms of creating our own reality. What do I mean by a lifestyle adjustment? Well, the most basic assumption regarding life adjustment is that we change our thought and our actions will follow suit. And that's almost common sense. At least it seems to be. There's almost a common sense logic to the assumption. Unfortunately, it doesn't work. It works some of the times. Sometimes we have to act out the part and keep practicing until we begin to believe in the action. And that's how we reshape our thoughts. By the way, that is actually called cognitive behavior therapy. We reshape our thoughts by practicing the action, and consequently the associated actions of behavior become habit. Nike Corporation expressed this relationship really well in their catchy little phrase, just do it. It means do those things necessary to bring about the desired result. So just stop complaining about your weight and do something about it. However, in the real world of humans, it isn't worth squat as practical advice. It really isn't. Remember, just say no to drugs? Well, to say to someone, just do it, is not going to work. The catchy phrase, just say no to drugs, it didn't work. It didn't stop teenage drug abuse. The just do it slogan, it plays to the choir and not to those who lack motivation. If you want to make a lifestyle adjustment, you first need to get the message fixed and stable as to what it is you want to adjust. In other words, no mixed messages. I'm going to run out of time here in about 3 minutes, but this is super important. It's the mixed message part of the message is usually a but or an if that follows the primary directive. For instance, a mixed message. Here's one. I will go to the gym today, but I may have to cancel if I feel tired or have a headache. Another mixed message, I will go to the gym today if I'm not tired and don't have a headache. See the mixing that's going on? Fix the message. Get it fixed. Don't make it mixed. What's a fixed message? I will be at the gym at 3 p.m. today. Now, the fixed message is quite clear, and for many of us, would work well as a thought directive for action. Sometimes we have to start the fixed message as a directive that is specific to the individual. Print them out. Print them out and paste them up on your refrigerator. In big, bold letters, and paste them around your house, on your car. Each time you see the message, you are reading it without putting a qualifier on it. The qualifiers is what makes it mixed. The qualifier only comes into play if you are thinking about the message as a directive. If you're simply reading the message, a qualifier is not going to happen, at least not on any consistent basis, because you're just looking at it. It's just passing in front of you. You're just reading a sign. That sort of practice, it takes little effort, and it begins to imprint a fixed directive without a qualifier. After a few weeks of getting really bored with the sign, you can start moving on. Practice reading the message out loud in front of a mirror. If the qualifier sneaks in, stop and do something else until you're ready to try again. Now, some behavior therapists have suggested self-punishment for unwanted thoughts, such as snapping an elastic band on the wrist. That's not necessary. It really isn't. The simple boredom with the exercise will eventually cause you to internally think the message without the qualifier. It's that simple. Well, it is 55 minutes. I've given you the best shot I can at creating your own reality, folks. Join us tomorrow. We are going to have Linda Linderman at 3:30 Pacific Time discuss identity theft and how to protect ourselves from it. Thank you for listening. I wish you all a wonderful day. That's a wrap, Don.